This upcoming concert season will be all about the boots, and Tecovas is your stop for the best in Western style. Tecovas has seasonal and limited edition offerings this spring and summer, including men's and women's boots, apparel, hats, bags, and more. All Tecovas boots are made by hand in a time-honored tradition with timeless styles that are always on trend. And Tecovas has first wear comfort with little to no break-in period. It's hard to find this level of comfort paired with this level of style. Stop by your local Tecovas store, have a complimentary drink or two, that's WCB style, and shop new styles. The smell of fresh leather and friendly staff are at your service. Many stores even have leather custom branding to make your boots truly personalized. And with regular live music and events, there's no in-store experience like it. If you can't make it into a store, just visit tecovas.com. That's T-E-C-O-V-A-S.com. They offer free shipping on all boots, as well as free returns and exchanges, and ship right to your door. Go to tecovas.com and find your new favorite pair of boots today.
Fishing like a local isn't just about catching fish. It's about connecting with the environment and the people who call it home. It's about hearing the stories and traditions that have been passed down for generations and sharing unforgettable moments with the people you meet along the way. Fishing like a local is having an experience that stays with you forever. And with Fishing Booker, you can experience it too, no matter where you are. Discover your next adventure on Fishing Booker.
This episode is brought to you by Bumble. So, you want to find someone you're compatible with, specifically someone who's ready for a serious connection, totally open to having kids in the future, is a tall, rock-climbing Libra, and loves rom-coms with vegan pizzas on Tuesdays just as much as you do. Bumble knows that you know exactly what's right for you. So, whatever it is you're looking for, Bumble's features can help you find it. Date now on Bumble.
Hunt of a lifetime. Changing lives one adventure at a time, empowering kids with courage. Join us in creating memories for kids facing life-threatening illnesses. We are here to make dreams come true. From magical outdoor escapades to heartwarming experiences, every moment is cherished. With every step of our young heroes, find a network of support, love, families, volunteers, and friends unite to uplift spirits and spread smiles. Amidst breathtaking landscapes, kids find strength they never knew they had. Together, we conquer challenges and celebrate victories. Be a part of the movement that transforms lives. Your contribution can bring courage and hope where it's needed most. Go to huntofalifetime.org to get involved. Let's create a world of cherished moments and unstoppable bravery. Brought to you in part by Maine Operation Game Thief, New Hampshire Wildlife Heritage Foundation, International Wildlife Crime Stoppers, and the North American Game Warden Museum. Please join me, Game Warden Wayne Saunders, and other Game Wardens on our adventures, protecting wildlife, saving lives, and having fun, all while serving the public and the natural resources of our planet. Listen to the tales and experiences of those who work in the outdoors while being entertained with stories about encounters with poachers, wildlife investigation, murder investigation, near-death experiences, search and rescue missions, wildlife interactions from game wardens around the country and around the world. When I retired, I realized I couldn't let go of that legacy, but rather wanted to share the passion, the commitment, and the stories of those men and women that call themselves game wardens. This is Game Warden Wayne Saunders, and this is Warden's Watch. Warden's Watch, episode 119, Martin Thibault, Canada. And I'm going to leave it at Canada because Martin, as you guys are going to find out, is a federal officer for the country of Canada, and he's going to describe what his jurisdiction is and what he does, and as well as give me a little geography lesson. So always a pleasure. That's what I love about these podcasts. I learn a lot of things too. And it's just a joy to sit down and talk with some of these officers and
engage them in something that I don't know and that I can be educated on. So, but before we get into that, I just wanted to read a Christmas card to you guys that I got from my former colonel, Colonel Ron Alley. And Ron was the colonel that actually hired me. So, and also he was the colonel when I was shot in the line of duty and gave me a lot of support. It did some cutting edge things back 25 years ago, critical incident debriefing, wasn't really just maybe just starting, as well as counseling. So Ron kind of guided me through that time, and I think it was well worth it. So he says, Merry Christmas to all. Thank you for all the support and efforts you gave to me and the department. My dentist has a friend who knows a game warden who does a thing called a podcast. Believe me, before I left the office, we had him on the phone, and I straightened him out on a few things about Lieutenant Wayne Saunders. Ron and Sherry, and I appreciate that. That was really good to hear from him, and apparently we're getting out when the dentist is talking about the podcast. So that's a good thing. So you guys, next time you're in there getting your teeth cleaned or whatever, you should talk to your dentist about the podcast and see if he's listening to Warden's Watch. Thank you for listening. Please share and enjoy as we go to Canada with Martin Thibault.
I'm sitting down with Martin Thibault. He's an operations manager and training specialist for Environment Canada, which is also environment, climate control, and you are the wildlife enforcement agency federally for the country of Canada.
We are. I mean, we are the counterpart of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service in Canada, basically. We don't do exactly the same thing, but it's very close to what the U.S. Fish and Wildlife does in the States.
So you have jurisdiction from one ocean to the other, just like U.S. Fish and Wildlife does?
We do, yes, we do. We have five different regions. I mean, we have a region out west, Pacific and Yukon, and then we have Prairie and Northern Region, which is all your central Canada, including the Northwest Territories and Nunavut. And then you have the bigger provinces of Ontario and Quebec, who are their own region. And then we have one region that covers Atlantic Canada, the maritime provinces of Canada.
And you'd have a different fisheries division that did fisheries enforcement, or
we do? Yeah, we don't deal with fish unless there's interprovincial or international trade. Typically, your fisheries will be handled by the various provinces, and commercial fisheries, generally speaking. Commercial fisheries will be under our Department of Fisheries and Oceans, which is like your NOAA. Exactly. Yeah. Yes.
And they have officers as well.
They have officers as well. Yes, they have officers as well. They're a bigger department than we are. I wouldn't be able to tell you exactly how many officers DFO has, but they're slightly bigger than us.
That's a huge resource for Canada, is their oceans.
It is, because we have the Pacific Ocean out west, we have the Arctic Ocean in northern Canada, and we have, of course, the Atlantic Ocean on the eastern coast. So a huge resource for us, for sure.
Now you're in training, but I want to go back to your roots. And you were an investigator initially, right? I mean, that's part of your job, just like a U.S. Fish and Wildlife agent?
Yep, exactly. I mean, I started as basically... what the U.S. Fish and Wildlife would call a refuge officer. Mm-hmm. That's how I really started my career. And then when we first met, I'd say I was probably an investigator in Montreal. I was hired back then to do, we were newly in the business of controlling wildlife trade, all the CITES species. And we got, of course, we got positions and budgets to deal with this new mandate, and that's how I got hired in Montreal, and that's how we got to know each other, right?
Yeah, right over the border in Montreal.
Yep.
So that was really, really good connection early on in both of our careers, and
it was
as we progressed. Now you're in training, and you're in charge of training for the feds.
Officially, I'm a lone resource. I mean, I'm still in my operations manager. I started, like you said, I started my career in Quebec, and I did leave at one point. I left for about a year, to do like your USDA would do in the, does in the States, right? The agricultural enforcement. I went for 1 year and I came back to wildlife enforcement. But when I came back, that's when I left Montreal and started working in Ottawa. And I worked for a couple of years. I worked for our headquarters office. And then I became a manager in Ontario region for the Eastern and Northern District. So basically an office in Ottawa and an office in Sault Ste. Marie, Ontario, just across from Sault Ste. Marie, Michigan.
Yeah.
Officers, you know, enforcing federal law across Northern and Eastern Ontario.
And how many federal agents do you have in your department?
I just did the roster with NUIA. We're just under badged officers. We're just under 100 right now. That includes all the directors, regional directors, and the managers. Field officers, it's probably fair to say that, you know, when all positions are staffed, probably 65 to 70 field officers.
Nice. All doing federal enforcement, just like ours would do. So you focus on the federal laws, not the provincial laws.
Yes. Depending on the jurisdiction, I mean, some of our regions, like in Ontario, where I'm, my substantive position is located, we do the provincial enforcement as well. But it's just incidental to our federal duties. I mean, we're not out there enforcing the provincial legislation. We're just appointed to deal with it if we find something illegal. But our main mandate is wildlife trade. So basically, your import and export of endangered species, whatever is controlled by CITES, or whatever is imported into the country illegally, like the Lacey Act does in the States. And the interprovincial stuff, again, similar to the Lacey Act in the U.S. I mean, if wildlife is harvested illegally in a province and transported in a different jurisdiction, we can deal with that. We can enforce it. We can take action when dealing with illegally traded wildlife. The other main piece of legislation that we enforce is the Migratory Bird Convention Act, which is the equivalent of your Migratory Bird Treaty Act. And to a lesser extent, we deal with federal wildlife areas, basically federally protected areas. We do where we do own the land. Various activities are permitted depending on the level of protection that's granted to the protected area. So it can go from anywhere to prohibited access to some of our wildlife areas will allow people to hunt as long as you have the proper permits to do so, depending on the jurisdiction. The nature of the work, depending on the protected area, the nature of the work we do will change drastically. And then the one last thing that the more recent piece of legislation is Federal Endangered Species Act, which is really meant to be a safety net. Say, for instance, if a province or a territory doesn't have their own legislation to protect endangered species, they can use or we can come in and deal with the enforcement, do various actions to protect the endangered species in those areas. But that's usually as a safety net. Like I said, it's a provincial jurisdiction, but we'll come in to assist if there's a need to do so. So
nice.
That's pretty much the spectrum. I mean, we only have four acts that we enforce. We're also appointed to do some of the provincial, the enforcement of some of the provincial legislation. And some of our officers, interestingly, some of our officers are, we call them cross-designated because our department also deals with the environmental enforcement, like your EPA.
Okay.
In the States. We have part of our enforcement branch does the environmental enforcement, and some of our officers are cross-designated. So, say, for instance, in a remote area like in Nunavut, we have officers that are cross-designated so they can deal with whatever. If there's an oil spill that affects the environment, they can deal with it. And the same oil spill could also have an impact on seabirds, for example. So they will be appointed to deal with it either under the Environmental Protection Act or under the Migratory Bird Convention Act. So they'll be able to use both tools because they're appointed under each piece of legislation.
Nunavut?
Nunavut, yeah, that's the youngest territory. It used to be, the Northwest Territories used to be one huge area.
Uh-huh.
And I think it was 1999 that we got a third territory called Nunavut, and it's a jurisdiction where the Inuit do their own, they have their own government. It's them to manage it as they deem fit, and it's been that way since 1999.
Wow, and that's not really well known. I wouldn't think so.
No. Unless you're a geography buff, I mean, you wouldn't necessarily know.
Yeah, I mean, as you're talking, yeah, that was the second time I heard Nunavut, and I'm like, now wait a second here.
Yep.
So thanks for explaining that part of the Northwest Territories.
Northwest Territories was broken down into, you know, a part, a western part that remains called to this day the Northwest Territories, but the eastern and all the Baffin lands became most of the Baffin lands became Nunavut in 1999. And it's a different jurisdiction with its own enforcement agency. They have their own COs. They have their, they do, you know, it's their, it's a different administration.
Mm-hmm. Now,
First Nation administration.
Okay. And that's what I was just going to ask about.
Yep.
First Nation. So it's indigenous people, basically.
Most of the population in Nunavut is First Nations.
First Nation.
Yes.
No, very, very interesting. And their laws have to be very different, the general provinces, I would imagine, because of that.
Well, they have First Nation.
Much like our tribal.
Yes, they have their own. And it's built into our constitution, actually. I mean, First Nations have a right to harvest resources for sustenance. And, of course, I mean, they're allowed to do so. And it's no matter where in Canada, they have, you know, there's treaties that have been signed that are honored. And where First Nations are allowed to harvest and, you know, be it fish or wildlife, and it's well recognized. It's a constitutional right for them to do so.
Gotcha.
So it's overall legislation. I mean, the way our constitution is, we have the Charter of Rights where and the Constitution Act. And these two pieces are... All federal law has to obey the principles of our Constitution and Charter of Rights. So whatever is built in there is over and above all federal law.
Gotcha.
Similar to...
Very similar
yeah, yeah.
to our tribal...
I would say, yeah. Yeah, it's probably very similar.
Except how much does Nunavut cover?
Oh, that's a good question. It's a big territory. I mean... when you look at the Baffin lands, I mean, it's a huge area. It's not densely populated, but it's huge. I'd say the biggest provinces, I believe, is Quebec, and I'm not sure which one is bigger, Ontario or Nunavut, but it's up there. I mean, it's a large, very large area. It goes all the way up to, I'm not sure, the... I-80s, as far as latitude goes.
Wow.
Yeah, very close to Greenland, of course, and quite close to the North Pole as well, right?
So. Wow. So it's located on the eastern side of Canada?
Nunavut is central. I mean, it's if you look at the map, I mean, you look at Canada and you go all the way up and you'll see there's several islands in northern Canada, and that's all pretty much part of Nunavut, and they're all that's the extent of the territory. It's big, it's huge.
It's pretty cool getting a little geography lesson here on the Warden's Watch podcast, because I'm thinking, if I don't know, probably half the people don't know listening about that. It's like that you're talking about some fantasy land there. You know, the Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. We're going to take a little trip to Nunavut,
and it's not easy to visit. I mean, it's quite expensive to go there.
Yeah.
So, I mean, we have national parks. I mean, there's areas that you can visit, and the people are very welcoming. But it's a different. I mean, it's not a very well known destination. It's unfortunate because it's very pretty. Yeah,
mm-hmm.
The Arctic is very pretty, very sensitive, but also very pretty.
You've spent some time up in that area.
I was there. I visited a few times. Yes, I didn't spend. I when I started my career, I worked in northern Canada, but I was more on the eastern side. I was working, in the easternmost part of the province of Quebec, which was sometimes within walking distance of Labrador. So again, it's a different, Canada's huge. I mean, it's over 3,000 miles across. So it's very, it varies. I mean, from the East Coast to the West Coast and from the southernmost tip to the Baffinlands. I mean, it's yeah, there's, like the U.S. really with, you know,
right.
With the Pacific Islands and Alaska and all the continental U.S., I mean, you get a tremendous variety of habitats and wildlife and so forth. So
yeah, no, for sure. And within those provinces, it always amazes me, Quebec, being a French-speaking province when everybody else is English.
Yeah.
And that's, it's like stepping, you know, of course, I border Quebec, so I've had that experience my whole life, but it's kind of odd to go to another spot in Canada and they speak English to you. So that's what always, I'm so used to hearing the French all the time that when I go to somewhere else in Canada and we speak English, it just kind of blows my mind every time. I'm like, this cracks me up. Quebec's right there. We've been dealing with speaking French people, and which is nice because some of the cases we've had on the border, I've had to call in some, you know, the game wardens from Quebec province so they can interpret.
Of course.
So, which has been really cool. And it was funny is once they got there, the other guys seemed to speak English okay. Yeah.
Sometimes they just need a little incentive.
Yeah. Can you give us a case that you've worked on that's pretty cool, and especially in that federal realm of Canada and what you do specifically?
I mean, I was a field officer for many years in Quebec. I mean, once
where always the good stories come from.
Yeah, one good case that comes to mind. I mean, it's a little dated, but it was how I started working with U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service back in the day. We had a commercial outfitter that was baiting heavily in the St. Lawrence River corridor, maybe an hour and a half east of Montreal. A very well-known outfitter, and we had reasons to believe that the success rate was fairly high. And there had to be a reason for it to be that way. So we worked with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, and you know Pat Bosco really well.
Oh,
right?
Yes, I do.
And Kevin O'Brien back in the day. Yeah. And we got them to come in as, you know, undercover officers. And, of course, they confirmed that there was a lot of baiting going on. And we did the takedown on this place. And that was, I mean, that's a while ago. That was in 1994. So it was my first case that I really worked with U.S., you know, be it state or, in this case, federal officers. But that's how I realized, you know, that there's a lot we can do together because we share a border, and we have a lot of hunters and fishermen that come to Canada to hunt and fish. And it's, you know, by working together and having a good partnership, you can accomplish so much more. And yeah, so this was the first, that's the cut that, I mean, it's not the most recent, but that's the one that comes to mind if you ask me. That was a very...
this was a duck case.
It was a duck, waterfowl, yeah.
And they were putting the corn right to the docks, or I take it.
Yeah, I mean, this area of the St. Lawrence River, it's all small islands, very marshy. And of course, I mean, it's all, you know, ponds mostly puddle ducks. I mean, it wasn't diving ducks. It was puddle ducks. And of course, I mean, when they're baited, they're much more predictable. And of course, you get a much higher success rate than if you just rely on your calling skills and your decoys and whatnot and being in the right place at the right time. Yeah. So there was a reason for the success rate. And sure enough, by working with U.S. Fish and sending off officers in there, we were able to charge. And it's funny because we did another takedown probably, I'd say...
When you go out there and the fish are where you think they are, any one of these casts could be the bite. It's the most exciting fishing that I know right here at Hawk's Cay.
Oh, that's awesome.
Experience the best saltwater fishing the world has to offer. Don't miss Thursdays with Saltwater Experience. Brought to you by Golden Boat Lifts. Every Thursday night from 7 to 10 p.m. Eastern on Waypoint TV. The destination for outdoor entertainment.
Brave anglers search for the one they call king, but who will take his throne? Tune in to Waypoint TV's Battle for Silver, Saturday, May 18th from 12 to 6 p.m. Eastern, presented by Abyss Battery. Waypoint TV.
15 to 18 years after, I was involved in the first takedown, and we, I mean, you know, sometimes we deal with chronic people, chronic offenders. So we, this, you know, this particular business was charged back in 1994. And then again, it, I think two or three times between 2010 and today. So yeah. So it's, you know, I was involved in the first takedown, and I got there again in 2012 and dealt with the same people. So familiar faces. Yes. Not, I mean, not bad folks by any, not at all. I mean, it's just, there's a lot of pressure with outfitters and whatnot, right? They have to perform, and sometimes the stakes are high, and it's tempting. So
yeah, and when you're making money off of wildlife,
exactly,
corruption has a tendency to seep into that.
Yep.
And when your success rate's high, you're either really good or you're cheating.
Exactly. That's a good way to put it.
And I have a friend that calls me up every time he gets a big deer, so he gives me blow by blow, so he doesn't think I'm cheating, because I always tell him that. I'm like. He's like, I don't want you to think I'm cheating because I got another huge buck here.
Yeah.
Oh.
I mean, it's, we all know, right? It's sometimes, especially when dealing with wildlife enforcement, it's getting to be serious. I mean, but if you go back, you know, 20, 25 years, I mean, the penalties were not always in line with the, they were not always a deterrent. Let's just put it this way. It's changing. I mean, we now have mandatory minimum fines and so forth. It becomes more of a deterrent. So
yeah,
but it, often it's you know, it's very low risk for an offender to be caught, and it's tempting. I mean, it's, yeah, they look at the profit that can be made and the risk of getting caught, and yeah,
absolutely.
Especially, and I'm sure you've seen the same thing.
Yeah, anytime you're going to make money off of wildlife, there is corruption. It
yep.
doesn't. It just matters what degree, where you're at. Whoever saw the glass eel thing coming with the elvers and stuff, when you're getting thousands and thousands and thousands of dollars a pound,
right?
And people are going out and making $100 in an evening by harvesting, you know, wildlife beyond its limits.
Tempting, very yes. tempting.
Absolutely, and almost like you said, when the fines aren't
in line,
it's worth the risk.
Exactly.
It's almost like you have to go off the book sometime when you do that.
Right.
So, yeah, very interesting. And import and export out of Canada, I'm sure, just like the U.S., there's all kinds of issues with that. Mm-hmm. I'm just wondering what you see in coming into Canada illegally and what you see going out of Canada illegally.
Coming into Canada illegally, I mean, it could be a very, you know, very anything, really. I mean, we have, you know... traditional Asian medicine often contains endangered species, so we tend to see a lot of that. It's often region specific. Like, for example, it's more common to deal with traditional Asian medicine in Vancouver, for example, where the Asian population is higher, and in Toronto, whereas in other ports of entry, it wouldn't be that common to see the same commodity. Anything really. I mean, it could be a timber trade. It's pretty big. The problem with timber is often we can identify the wood. I mean, we can do you know, lab analysis and whatnot, and we were able to identify the wood, but they're not always protected by CITES. Only a few specific species of trees are protected by CITES. But the issue with timber is that there's a lot of illegal logging going on. In Russia, for example, seems to be a hotspot for illegal timber operations. But if you're not dealing with a protected species, then you have to demonstrate that it was taken illegally. And if you're dealing with a piece of lumber
coming from Russia
and being often transiting in a third, you know, in another country, then it becomes hard to establish that the commodity is illegal. So unless we're dealing with the actual CITES species, the mahogany comes to mind. The mahogany is protected, and it's fairly easy to identify. So if you're dealing with something that's easily identifiable, then you know there needs to be a permit. But if it's a you know, timber that was harvested illegally in a foreign nation and it gets imported into Canada, we still have the burden to prove that the timber was illegally harvested. And it's not always easy to do so. Because like anything else, I mean, it gets laundered, right? It gets laundered by just making it transit through, you know, another country. And then it gets re-exported and you kind of lose track. You cannot establish where it's coming from. So even though you may be able to prove that country X has strict export laws, or, I mean, if it comes from country X, but it transits through country Y before coming to either Canada or the U.S., then it's not easy. Yeah.
No. Very, very interesting. I think it's the first lumber discussion I've had on the Watch podcast. It's
That's one of the things. Anything that is controlled by and country, I'm not sure. I don't think it's the same in the U.S. because I think the lumber is handled by USDA. Mm-hmm. Don't quote me on this. When I was a field officer, it was that way. Anything wildlife was U.S. fish, but if it was timber or plants, it was USDA.
Sounds correct.
It may have changed. But no, as when it comes to the enforcement of CITES in Canada, imports and exports, it is all of our under our mandate.
And it's all about the inexpensiveness of that lumber, I would assume, when it comes into that market, depending where it comes from. It's either high end or low end.
So, exactly.
I know we talk about the legalization of marijuana with John Norris a lot because he saw California legalize it, yet it didn't take the illegalness out of the other stuff. It actually enhanced it because of the cost of the legal stuff.
Yep.
So, and nobody wants to pay, you know, 70% in taxes and
exactly
it's up that high.
Same thing.
And then they filter that illegal stuff into the legal stuff. It just becomes dirty.
Exactly.
Well, the same way with the lumber is what you're talking about.
No, exactly the same thing. I mean, it's, again, high profit, low risk. I mean,
And when people start hearing you're investigating the lumber company, you know, I mean, they're going to be like, what the heck?
Exactly. People don't always know, you know, what's at stake and whatnot. But that's what I know. That's one of the things that we do. And you were asking about Canadian species. Canadian species, we're really concerned with our marine mammals, like walrus, the narwhal, polar bears, and so forth. But we've done a pretty good job of ensuring compliance with those species over the years. So that's one of the concerns that we have. We also have hunting trophies. They're not always necessarily controlled by CITES, but again, I mean, if there's high value sheep or moose or whatever, I mean, there's always the risk of, you know, dealing with illegal activities because of the profit involved and whatnot, right?
Right.
It when you want to do stuff legally and you need to hire the outfitters and purchase the tags and whatnot, it's pretty expensive, and it's tempting for illegal operations to offer the same thing, you know, at a more competitive rate, but right, not necessarily in a legal way, right?
Yeah.
So as far as Canadian species is concerned, bears, marine mammals, definitely something that that comes out of Canada that we need to monitor. Eel, same thing. Same thing. A lot of the European eel is controlled by CITES. I'm not sure. Not sure about the American eel. I know we've had cases where we were dealing with a lot of, you know, bulk eel shipments, and you get a mixture of both, right?
Right?
And they're all in the same shipment, so you need to have a sampling protocol to establish how much, you know, European eel has been smuggled. And it's, again, it's not something that's definitely necessarily black and white. I mean, it's a bit of a gray area and a bit of a slimy area when it comes to eels.
Yes, sure. Sampling eels, I'm like, wow, that's you're getting slimy for sure.
Of course, yeah.
So, and then to identify European eels facing against the American eel.
It has to be done, you know. We send that to the lab. It has to be DNA. Has to be DNA, because you wouldn't be able to tell. I mean,
no, not in the field. I can't.
No,
imagine.
No. Maybe if you had to, you know.
And technically, I think it would be a Canada eel.
Yeah, I mean, maybe if you had the fish in the tank and you could look at it, you know, take your time and look at it, but when it's
after it's harvested. And,
yeah, no way.
Or even processed for that matter.
Exactly. Yeah. No, frozen sometimes even. So, yeah. No, you can't. You just can't.
And I don't think listeners understand how slimy this job gets sometimes, especially when it comes to fish and commercial fishing and crawling into these things to look at catches and bycatch. And yeah, especially what you had was a clean uniform, and now you're going to go home and throw it away.
Exactly. No, it can be a messy business.
Or with dead things, too. Dead things, when things get rotted and you have to investigate, when we're the CSI of wildlife.
That's what we do.
Yeah, yeah. And that can, I have seen many a man hurling over what we have to do. Vicks under your nose, whatever you got to do. It's just, yeah.
Sometimes it's a messy business.
And you get used to it eventually.
Of course, like anything else.
Yeah, the old solid guy always loves to bring the trainee and have him, you know, do his first moose autopsy. When the thing's so bloated and it's, you know, I remember, and I probably have told this story on Warden's Watch before, Brian Gillis, who's actually a major in New York now, I had him, he was started in New Hampshire, and he had his first moose autopsy, and the thing was bloated up so loud, so big, Martin. So when he just punctured that gasket, it blew his hair straight back like he was Marilyn Monroe's skirt. And the stench was so bad. For 10 minutes, I think he dry heaved. And I laughed. I couldn't. I laughed so hard it hurt. that's the video that I want to
you just picture it. Yeah, Kodak moment for sure.
Yeah, so that's when it's nice to get up in the ranks. You don't have to squirrel around so much, but when a helping hand is needed, many a times I've held that leg and act along with them.
It's good to stay grounded. Mm. Yeah.
Very much so. I'm glad you said that. It's good to stay grounded. It's good to remember what the guys are beginning or going through.
Yep.
And staying connected and grounded. And, I think it makes you, a much better supervisor.
Of course it does. Of course it does. I'd never, you know, ask somebody else to do something I wouldn't do.
Right.
So,
or you haven't done in the past.
Exactly.
Oh, I definitely, there's certain things I probably wouldn't do anymore, but I'm done. Been there, done that.
Right.
Now it's your turn, bud. Oh, I'm here. I'm your support system. But
fair.
I always loved getting into those lower cases. I thought that was the best part about being a lieutenant. I got to go wherever a hot case was and not have the paperwork.
Yep.
So,
well, yeah.
You know, hold the leg to the moose, or you know, use your experience and your interview skills to get that information out. And I really enjoyed that because I got involved in a lot more cases, other than my own.
Yep.
That I didn't get the paperwork to go with it.
And that's what a supervisor should do. I mean, you should, you know, share whatever you know, your knowledge, your experience, and that's why I enjoy, you know, working with the training branch so much, because I find it rewarding to share my experience. What's the point of, you know, retiring at what point and leaving with your knowledge and not letting anybody else have it? I mean, you might as well pass it on. What's the point? I mean, if you're not going to be working in enforcement anymore, what's the point of holding on to, you know, whatever you know, be it knowledge of the resource or knowledge of a technique or interview skills, whatever. I mean, it's rewarding to pass it on and see somebody else use it and take it further and become better, and I find
it's rewarding. Even as a retired guy, officers call me every now and then and say, hey, you dealt with this guy, hey, you know, this area, and you know, it's just that's rewarding to have them,
of course it is,
suck that knowledge from you.
Yeah, what's the point in keeping it to yourself? I mean, we're not going to be dealing with the offenders anymore, we're not going to be as involved with a resource. I mean, you might as well let somebody else have it and become part of their learning experience.
Right. And I know I got a lot of young game wardens, game warden babies, as Georgia likes to call them, listening to this. But I got to tell you, use those resources of those retired wardens that are in your area, you know, your supervisors. But those retired guys, they have so much knowledge and they want to share.
Of course.
They want to jump in your cruiser for a day and tell you about everything. And it might be, the information might be a little outdated.
Yeah.
Sometimes, but you're going to gain so much knowledge so much quicker by taking a day and talking to the retired warden, having him ride in your cruiser. He's going to love that you're doing that, you're sucking that information out, and you are going to be learning so much so quick.
And don't be afraid to ask. I mean, there's there isn't a stupid question. There isn't, I mean, it doesn't matter. Right. It doesn't matter at all. I mean, if somebody is going, nobody's going to judge you for asking a question. I mean, unless you keep asking the same question over and over again.
Until you get the answer you want.
Yeah.
That's just human nature.
Yeah.
Sweet. So, yeah, no, thanks for sitting down and
it was a pleasure
having this little chat and kind of filling us in Canada, the mirror of the North American experience, which we mirror each other quite well.
We do. We do. I mean, the work that we do, I mean, the legal systems are somewhat different. I mean, they're similar, but somewhat different. But the nature of the work and, you know, the modus operandi of the offenders, and often we deal with the same resource. We deal with the same challenges. We deal with very similar people. We don't exactly go about it the same way because of our legal systems, and we have, you know, to respect people's rights and so forth and make sure that they're prosecuted fairly and whatnot. But, I mean, we have basically a game warden is a game warden no matter where you work. That's why I enjoy coming to these conferences so much, because you get to share with people you'd never talk to otherwise unless, you know, you're all in the same spot and sharing stories and whatnot. So take advantage of the training sessions, take advantage of the business meetings and see what people are doing. And you learn from other people's experiences. Again, I mean, we have so much in common that the more we share, the better off we are.
And then networking. I know the Colonel of Tennessee referenced that, and it's priceless.
It is.
Communication has changed so much in our tenure with so much digital information available, but nothing beats sitting down with your peers.
No.
Cramming out cases, having that chat, experiences, trends. There's a lot changing in wildlife, for sure. Mm-hmm. We are definitely seeing the end, maybe, of traditional working night hunters with thermals.
Yep.
And some states are, and maybe provinces as well, are experiencing a lot more uptick in thermal use. And other states, they're going to be experiencing that. But let's suck the knowledge that they're learning out of ahead of time. Drones are going to be so much more in use.
Of course.
From the poacher aspect and
the
enforcement.
And then you get into, you know, all the challenges that go with it. I mean, the privacy expectations, and it's a fine line. I mean, it's technology that we can use, but we need to be...
What is the curtilage in the air? And
exactly.
When I talk about curtilage, we're talking about around houses. And
yes.
Can we put a drone 300 feet above? Is that still in their curtilage?
Exactly.
There's a lot of questions to be asked.
There's a lot of questions to be asked, and the courts will have to clarify these questions.
Right.
It's, you know, it's uncharted. I mean, nobody, it's something that we have never done before.
Yeah.
And we'll have to learn how to use it properly. And I'm sure there's going to be case law, and both positive and negative, that they're going to be, you know, setting the boundaries as to how we can use it.
Yeah. I find that exciting. I find
it is
changing, and how we address them, and how we, and you can't be scared to. You got to charge forward with what you have.
Exactly.
Like you said, there's going to be decisions made. You may think it's bad, but those are the things. But make the best case possible and put that forward, and then let the courts make that decision.
Exactly. So let your prosecutor guide you.
Exactly.
And if your prosecutor is comfortable, I mean, why not? I mean, we need to clarify that whole technology, new technology
I know
resource.
We've seen some guiding stuff with drones as far as guides locating moose. With drones.
That's, yep, you know, for sure.
You know, and giving that edge now, which, you know, we don't want to give that edge because if we over-harvest our animals, we know, I know Colorado expects 30% of their elk is going to be harvested compared to what they issue in tags. So that's the foundation. But if you up that edge with technology and they start using drones, and now 40%, 50%, 60% is now getting harvested because of technology, then that's just going to offset that whole dynamic.
Balance, for sure. Yep.
Yeah. Are you starting to see a lot of that in Canada?
I mean, it's out there. Mm-hmm. With what we do with waterfowl enforcement and international trade, not so much, but I'm sure provincial agencies are dealing with it a lot more when it comes to scouting for big game and locating, you know, trophy animals. I'm definitely something that the provinces are, I'd say, with certainty that they're dealing with it. The legislation has been changed. I mean, it's been modified to take into account that these tools are could be used, but I mean that doesn't mean that people are not doing it, right? So, right. I'm sure it's more of an issue with provincial partners.
Things will change. Technology's changing. Mm-hmm. And game wardens got to change with it.
We have to adapt.
Yeah.
Otherwise, we will become obsolete.
That's right. And I think the newer generation, because they're growing up and it has a much more adaptivity
yep.
compared to our generation, that, you know, we'll just keep doing it the way we've done it forever.
Right.
But we're not being effective by doing it that way.
Nope. We need to learn the new tricks.
Yes. Yes. The old drog needs to learn the new tricks.
Yes.
But no, thanks for sitting down with me, Martin, and, you know, sharing Canada's federal enforcement agencies, information and geography.
Yep. I'm glad we could do it because we spoke about it at the main field day 3 years back.
Yeah.
And then COVID hit, right?
Yeah.
So we didn't get a chance to really get together for a long time. So I'm glad we were able to do this today.
Right. And COVID helped my podcast a ton as far as, you know, I just started doing Zoom meetings and podcasting from that. And no one had a camera set up and no one knew how to do it. COVID hits and, you know, in 3 months, everybody was doing it. Again, I didn't have to take 30 minutes to explain and try to set things up. So I was just, I'm like, there's some good stuff that came out of COVID.
Of course.
It seemed like everybody and their brother started podcasting during COVID too, because they had nothing else to do. So I'm glad Warden's Watch got a bit ahead of that wave.
Right.
Because we definitely, we're ahead of the game, which I'm very happy. So yeah, as we're doing this, we're over 100,000 downloads in 6 months. So.
Whoa.
Yeah, so it's doing well.
Good.
So not the bottom feeder, I always tell people, but not the top. We're not a meat eater by any means, but, you know, that's our goal.
Good. That's a good place to be.
Thanks, Martin.
Thank you.
Please join me, Game Warden Wayne Saunders, and other Game Wardens on our adventures, protecting wildlife, saving lives, and having fun, all while serving the public and the natural resources of our planet. Listen to the tales and experiences of those who work in the outdoors while being entertained with stories about encounters with poachers, wildlife investigation, murder investigation, near-death experiences, search and rescue missions, wildlife interactions from game wardens around the country and around the world. When I retired, I realized I couldn't let go of that legacy, but rather wanted to share the passion, the commitment, and the stories of those men and women that call themselves game wardens. This is Game Warden Wayne Saunders.
In Wild Country, rules were not created by man. Don't miss Wild Country, Wednesdays from 7 to 11 p.m. Eastern. Presented by Primos. Speak the language. Waypoint TV, the destination for outdoor entertainment. On Mondays, head offshore with Captain Scott Walker and Steve Roger for breathtaking deep sea adventures.
Coming to me.
He's jumping.
Oh!
Look at that belly.
Don't miss Mondays with Into the Blue, brought to you by Academy Sports and Outdoors from 7 to 10 p.m. Eastern.
Tell a few fish stories along the way.
On Waypoint TV, the destination for outdoor entertainment.